Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another reality show. I'm your host, Golden Hawk, and I am excited to be here tonight. It's November 12th. That's right, the energies of 11-11 were going on yesterday, and there was a lot of buzz around that, at least on Facebook and the channelers and people that are within my field of awareness. So I hope everybody had a great 11-11, and today, of course, being 11-12, I have my a dear and wonderful friend who I'm going to read the formal introduction of you, Mr. Imbrogno. Okay, tonight's show, Philip Imbrogno has been investigating and researching paranormal phenomena for over 30 years. He has many degrees in astronomy and earth science, a master's degree in chemistry from MIT. He's been a science educator for the past 25 years. He's authored several books, magazines, articles on the paranormal. He has a book that is just coming out now called Files from the Edge, which I hope to talk about. He also had a book that came out last year, Interdimensional Universe, which is also a lot of fun, which I want to talk about. And he has worked with many groups bringing people to the local ancient sites of energy to help them connect with nature and the compact universe in which we are all a part of, which I'm always open to talking about. So welcome to the show, Phil.
Well, hello, Goldie.
How are you, my friend?
Well, I'm just doing just fine, but after, you know, teaching all day for 8 hours, you know.
Yes, indeed. So. I mean, yes, just so everybody knows, that Phil teaches what, 6th through 8th graders, correct?
8th graders.
Or just 8th graders.
8th graders.
Pardon?
8th grade. See, I've taught every grade.
Well, this year, are you in
8th grade and 6th grade.
8th grade and 6th grade, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And 5th grade.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, that's a rough one.
Yeah. Well, I would think the closer you got to puberty, the more it would become difficult to teach kids when their minds are elsewhere.
Not really, especially when you have them for a class when they just come in from recess.
Right. So meaning they're all relaxed because they just ran, you know, the quarter mile?
Well, you know, their own quarter miles outside.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, and also, I don't want to get into any details of your private life, but, I can't even imagine. It must be fabulous having you as a teacher, because I know that you have taught me many things on many occasions, including that I talk too loud at sacred sites. You are very astute at getting your point across to me, but I love you.
Well, you know, I am what I am. I mean, you know, whatever you hear come from my mouth is exactly what I feel. I'm not going to bullshit anybody, you know.
Indeed. Well, yeah, I'll be honest with you. I was just talking to a friend before the show about that. Speaking your mind and being authentic, I have found at this point in my life, that's the only people it seems to be around, left around me, people who take offense over direct expression of oneself. Which is also, you know, I feel I'm pretty direct as well, and your directness doesn't offend me at all. It keeps me in check. I like strength and I like directness, so I'm not offended. I enjoy it.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Enough of that. Okay. So first of all, Files from the Edge. Can we talk about that?
Sure.
Okay. Because now, if I'm correct, this is a book that you This is the book from all those audio tapes that you have in the upstairs?
Kind of, but it's also, it stems back to 1970, actually.
Okay, listen, I'm going to give the floor to you. Go, babe.
Yeah, it goes back to 1970. The other books I wrote were about, you know, the Hudson Valley UFO and people who claim contact and, you know, the stone chambers in the Hudson Valley and their ancient Celtic connection. And Interdimensional Universe was sort of like a collection of UFO and paranormal stuff merged together. But I had so many cases in my, you know, so many cases that were left in my files that, and some of them while I was in the military. So,
right.
You know, all these experiences that I've had. So I kind of like put them together to make this book, Files from the Edge. It's called The Paranormal Investigators, A Paranormal Investigator's Investigations or something into High Strangeness or
right.
something. Yeah, you know, I mean, you could just go on Amazon right now. The publisher is offering, you know, you can pre-order it. It's not coming out till April. But, you know, there's a lot of things in that book that I never even discussed with you in all the years that I've known you.
Oh, wow.
About some of the experiences that I've investigated or had been part of. And so I think it's going to be a pretty opening for people to read that, you know, that they not only take place in the United States. I tell the story of my explorations in Thailand and also in Nepal.
Wow.
So, you know, it takes place in different places around the world, but of course much of it is in fact in the United States. And it also takes in what I what's become somewhat of my trademark is that the idea of parallel universes generating paranormal phenomena and a whole range of paranormal phenomena.
Okay,
I mean,
so
if you want to talk about one story about Files from the Edge, I can. I mean, you know.
I absolutely want to do that, especially since I don't even know about this now. I'm clearly...
Well, of course you know, because, you know, when you read it, you'll be surprised.
And I was going to say, as soon as I will order the book. I very
well,
much
you're
enjoy
in Files from the Edge, you know.
The story from the Hawk Rock is in it?
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, I look forward. I know that story.
Well, you've read that story already.
I did. I read it at the, you had it at, we had a gathering and you
uh-huh.
let some of the chapters out. I mean, but of course I'm interested in things that I don't know that, you know, I'm fascinated with all of this. And, but what I want to do, okay, because this is, I mean, there's so much vastness to your knowledge and what you speak of. What you just said about, okay, now I know parallel universes, because again, interdimensional universe, you're not Files, but the book before that, you really spoke a lot about, you know, the bleed through, so to speak, of how things are happening, like in other universes, well, I can't even say, in other dimensions that are affecting our dimensions. I mean, I've had experiences of that. Can you share what you mean by, you know, parallel universes and having that become paranormal activity here?
Yeah, well, you know, most people, when they hear the idea of other dimensions and parallel universes, they can't differentiate the two. So, you know, without getting into a detailed explanation of physics, you know, you have to understand, and in the book I make it very clear in what string theory is and the idea of parallel universes and how string theory and all these other dimensions have been proven mathematically.
Okay.
And so the existence of these other dimensions that exist in our physical universe, you know, are being accepted widely now by theoretical physicists from some of the major institutions, you know, including you know, the home base MIT.
Right.
But the thing is that, you see, it was thought at one time that atoms were just particular points, like little tiny spheres, you know, 100 trillion of them lined up could fit on the head of a pin.
Okay.
This is what they've been teaching in high school, still teaching in high schools and colleges. And the theory is wrong. You know, our idea, our concept of the atom has changed so much over the years, since in the last 100 years. So it's still evolving. Now the idea that the atoms are not, you know, tiny points, but in fact strings, vibrating strings, and the vibration of those strings determines what particular particle is formed. And, of course, the particles determine the characteristics of matter. So you, if you can imagine this like a guitar string, okay?
Okay.
Each particular string on the guitar is pulled at a certain tension. If you strike each one, they produce a different note. Or if you move your finger up and down the, you know, the string, you can change the tone of the note. Imagine those strings in the universe vibrating, producing different particles that make up all the different matter.
Okay.
Now, strings can be open or closed. The fact is now that we're not dealing with the universe is tied together by all these strings. It's like a web, okay?
Okay.
So, you know, the ancients of long ago had this idea already. If, you know, these idiot scientists from the 50s and the 60s would have opened up their minds, you know, maybe we'd be 100 more years advanced in this idea by now. They laughed at the people in metaphysics and that said that the entire universe is connected,
right.
You know? And the fact is that because of string theory, it's a unifying theory. And it connects us here at planet Earth with the most distant parts of the physical universe.
Okay.
Which is an exciting thought, you know,
absolutely.
That we're all part of this net of like a big web in the universe, and it's all connected.
Well, you're bridging spirituality and science.
Well, this is exactly what's happened, metaphysics, as it was called. And so now, since these strings are two-dimensional and they produce these vibrations, and the vibrations, by the way, produce the characteristics of different elements. So the idea of what we view as the physical world is nothing more than a manifestation of electromagnetic fields.
Okay.
So when you touch something, you touch a wall, it's not really physical. It only feels physical because the strings are generating, through these particles that they're creating, electromagnetic fields. And you have electromagnetic fields in your body, and they repel each other. So it gives the impression that you're touching a solid wall. Well, theoretically, that if you didn't have that electromagnetic repelling force in your hand would be able to go right through the wall.
Well, so let me ask you a question. Through intention, can I alter my field?
You know what? I wouldn't rule it out at this point.
Indeed.
You know, the fact is that if we can find a way to alter the electromagnetic fields of our body by technology or whatever,
right, inner or outer,
theoretically, you can walk right through the wall. Of course, you'd probably fall through the floor, too.
I was going to say, huh?
You'd
essentially stop being physical, but maybe that's what is already showing up.
Or maybe you can just concentrate on your hand and put your hand through the wall and so on. But the thing is now we have these strings. These strings can fold on each other. So if these strings are folding on each other, they make up physical space. It's possible now that all of these other dimensions exist in the physical universe around us. Just think about the room that you're sitting in.
Okay.
Imagine in there, you're able to perceive, you're a three-dimensional being. So you'll be able to perceive the first dimension, second dimension, up to the third dimension.
Okay.
Now, string theory is telling us that there are at least 10 dimensions in the room with you. Now, originally, these are areas of space that are folded around in which you cannot see because you are a three-dimensional being. You cannot see the fourth curvature of space, the fifth curvature of space, all the way up to the tenth curvature of space. By the way, there are 11 dimensions, but that one's a special one. It's
called
the brain.
Can you get into that?
B-R-A-N-E.
Okay.
Now the thing is that you can't see these. Now, originally the theory called for these spatial dimensions to be very tiny, wrapped around about the size of an atom, so to be very, very tiny, so you couldn't see them anyway, but they were there.
Okay.
Now the theory is beginning to say, hey, you know, these spatial dimensions in the physical universe, remember, these other dimensions where you are not in some magical place at a higher frequency or whatever. They are physical areas in space that are outside the curve. Imagine this. Imagine a hose, okay?
Okay.
A hose, you know, you're a being, let's say you're on the outside of the hose.
Okay.
Okay? You walk around the hose, you know, it's round to you, right?
Right.
And that's all that you can do because that's your space. You have no idea that inside the hose is hollow. There's another universe in there. So this is what these other dimensions are to us in this space here. We cannot turn to walk into these other dimensions because we're locked into our three-dimensional space because our bodies are three-dimensional, and the strings that make us up that we're connected to are three-dimensional in nature.
Now, okay, but as a scientist, every rule has an exception.
Every what?
Every rule has an exception.
Well, you're talking about you want to go into these other universes? Of course it's possible. All you would have to do is turn the curvature of space, and you would be in there. But how do you do that? Well, there are theoretical ways to do it, but, you know, it's not feasible because we don't know how to do that particular thing. But, you know, going on with this is that these other dimensions that exist in our same space, but at different curvatures, like the hose. The hose takes up the same space, but there's a whole universe inside the hollow part of the hose if you're on the outside.
Right.
Now, gravity. Okay? Now, gravity should be one of the strongest forces in the universe, but it's not. It's the weakest force.
Really?
Yes, it is. And the fact is that no one for years could explain why gravity is so weak. You have an object the size of the sun, and, you know, everything should go crashing into it, be pulled into it, but it doesn't. The fact is that if you put all of these other dimensions into the equation, gravity, by the way, is not restricted by the dimensions. It flows through the universe. It's transparent through the universe. And it goes through all these other dimensions, okay? So by the time, let's say the Earth and the Sun, the distance from the Earth and the Sun, by the time the Sun's gravity reaches us, it is already filtered out through all these spaces, spatial dimensions, making the pull of gravity of the Sun a lot weaker than it should be on planet Earth. And so, you see, the idea of the weakness of gravity gives support to the idea of these other dimensions. Now, these are other dimensions. They're right in our physical universe. They're right in the room where you are. It's a scary thought sometimes when you think that now people are considering that there might be intelligent beings there.
Well, right, it makes exploration, it opens up exploration dramatically.
Yes, but if they're in like the fifth or sixth dimension or so on, remember, they can see you, but you can't see them.
Well,
and the fact
why
is,
would that be? How would we know that? Okay.
Look at it this way. If there was a two-dimensional being, okay, a two-dimensional being would have their own universe. They would have no height. They can see back and forth and sideways, but they can't look up and they can't look down because they're two dimensions.
Okay.
They're totally flat.
Okay.
You're walking around in three dimensions. They can't see you. They can't even perceive you because you're up. If somehow you walk into their universe, all they see is like the bottom of your foot, a line.
Right.
And as you change direction, that line changes shape. And when you walk away from their sphere of visual sight, the line just seems to disappear.
Right.
Now, we see that phenomena a lot. We see things that are distorted, that appear and disappear, most likely because they're from a more other dimensional state. So the two-dimensional person can't see us. For example, if there were two-dimensional beings, let's say in a mythical land called Flatland.
Okay. There's actually a movie about this.
Now, if these two-dimensional beings are having a conversation, and all of a sudden you went down and picked up one of them, to his friends, this two-dimensional being would just vanished. And all of a sudden, he's in this other place. And he doesn't see all of it because he can only see, like, in thin lines. As you move him up and down, he gets a very, very narrow view of the three-dimensional universe, you know,
right.
Your room or something. Okay, you put the three-dimensional, two-dimensional being down. All of a sudden, he appears back in front of his friends, disappears there.
Right.
And they say, where did you go? And he's trying to point a direction. He's going back and forth and sideways, and he's trying to point. He said, I don't know where I went because they don't have the dimension of up and down because they're totally flat.
Right.
So we are beings in the three dimension. We're like the flatland people, the people who are in the fifth and sixth and maybe seventh dimension. But the dimension that is closest to us is probably dimension number five, if you want to give them numbers. Dimension number four is thought to be time.
That's what I had heard as well, exactly.
Okay, past, present, and future coexisting together. So theoretically, you see, we cannot go into the fourth dimension, because we can't turn into that area to travel back and forth into time. But a being who lives in the fifth dimension may be able to go into the fourth and the third, so they would be able to travel back and forth in time and come into our universe and interact with us, but we would have an incredible amount of difficulty interacting with them because we can't perceive their dimension, just like the guy from Flatland, who can't see the third dimension, only sees little thin views of realities of it.
Right, so does that mean the dimensions expand on each other?
Well, they wrap around each other, that's for sure.
Right.
But they wrap around each other in space and time. They curve space around each other so that if you're a being of that dimension, you can only stay on the curvature of space. So if you're a third-dimensional being, you can perceive the first, second, and third dimension, but you can't perceive the fourth or fifth. But if you have a being in the fifth dimension, they could perceive the fourth, third, the second, and the first dimension.
Right.
You see?
Right. Building on each other is what...
Well, that's true, yes.
Okay.
And now the fact is, those are other dimensions. Those are physical areas in your space. They're not on higher dimensions. They're not in another universe somewhere. They're in the same room with you.
Right.
Okay? So, but you can't perceive them. Sometimes I think people do perceive beings from these other dimensions because they just see them as shadows.
Right.
Now, other universes. Imagine that all of these other dimensions, including ours, are like drops of water on, let's say, a big sheet of glass.
Okay.
Each one of those drops of waters represents a galaxy. Okay? They represent a galaxy. And inside each of those drops of water are all these other dimensions. But there's a space between all of these drop of water, and they're clinging on to something. This is the 11th dimension, called the membrane, called brain for short,
okay,
in which all of our reality is on this membrane. And this membrane, by the way, separates all the other universes in our physical reality. And within that are all these other dimensions. Now, in creation, in the multiverse, there are countless numbers of other panes of glass with water drops on them representing all these other universes and all these other dimensions. So you have this idea of the multiverse where creation is incredibly complex. And the thing is that all of these membranes, these brains, they're all in motion in relation to each other. And there may be billions of them. And one brain can contain an entire universe. Sometimes the theory is that these brains actually collide with each other and annihilate each other and then recreate a group of tinier universes or are, in fact, one large one. And this is what they think, theoretical physicists think, how the Big Bang formed now, you know?
Well,
is that these brains, theoretically, they occasionally annihilate themselves and reform. But there's a theory, there's a paradox here.
Okay.
There's a theory that's called the Hawkins paradox.
Stephen?
And it says, Stephen Hawkins, yeah, it says that any information, okay, any information that was used to create that universe, including probably down to intelligent beings, all that information cannot be destroyed. But when the universe reforms, all that information comes back together. So theoretically, according to this theory, if our universe was destroyed right now with two brains colliding together, maybe 10 billion years from now, we would be having this conversation again.
Because it existed in the first place?
Yes, because the information on who we are and what we're going to do and all of our past have been stored.
Well, let me ask you a question. Andromeda, is that a galaxy, or I might have my, like, aren't we on a collision course with Andromeda?
Yeah, we're on a collision course to it. It's moving to us in another, you know, 3-4 billion years.
I get that it's a long time away. Now, are we on a pane of glass and Andromeda is on their pane of glass?
No, it's on our pane of glass, and it's very close by. It's a nearby galaxy.
It's a galaxy, not a universe, because I'm not quite sure what makes something a universe.
Well, universe is an area of space that contains hundreds of billions of galaxies.
Okay.
In each galaxy, there are billions and billions and hundreds of billions of stars.
Okay.
With probably millions and millions and millions of planets.
Okay.
So in our universe, on our brain, so to speak.
Okay.
There are at least 300 billion galaxies, each with 100 billion stars.
Okay.
And in the multiverse, there are probably billions and billions of brains with hundreds of billions of galaxies on them, and so on and so on and so on.
Yeah, these numbers are so big, you can't even comprehend
them. Yeah, I know. You know, the number of billion was unknown until, like, the 20th century. Before that time, people used to think 1,000 was a lot.
Yeah, huh? It's interesting.
And then 1,000,000 came along, and people say, ooh. And now 1,000,000 means nothing, you know?
Well, and Google, what? Isn't Google actually a number?
Well, Google, yeah. A Google is like a million millions.
Yeah.
Okay? And a Googleplex is a Google, you know. So
we're not just talking internet.
The highest number is a Googleplex now. Do you know that if you started writing the zeros for a Googleplex, you would not live long enough?
Really?
Yeah.
To write them down.
To write the zeros.
So we're actually using these types of numbers and equations?
Well, we're not using Googleplex. It's just a theoretical number, but they're using, you know, trillions and hundreds of billions and so on. And, you know, and also using smaller numbers too, a 100 billion trillionth of a nanometer. I mean, you know, it's like a 125 trillionth of an inch.
Let me ask you a question though. Has numbers done anything, like, do we have any such thing as, like, negative numbers?
Yeah.
What I mean, because, like...
Of course.
Well, because I was watching a thing on the universe the other night on History Channel, and it was talking about, like, 73% of space is the unknown, this thing they call dark energy.
Yeah, well, you know, dark energy and dark matter are probably... gravitons and the fabric, like the glass I was talking about.
Okay.
We can't see that because we're on it.
Okay.
And it's all around us, by the way.
Right.
The dark matter is all around us, and this is what everything in our universe is attached to. It's the brain, the material of the brain that acts as the fabric of our universe. That's what probably dark matter is. And it's really close to you because you're attached to it, by the way.
What do you mean?
Well, you're attached to it right now. You're hooked on it. All particles except for gravitons are attached to the brain, which is the dark matter.
Oh, okay.
We call it dark matter because we can't see it. Why can't we see it? Because we're on it. You can't see it because you're on it. That's why.
So is that like the fish looking for water, you mean?
Well, yeah, kind of like that. It's the fish, you know, trying to, you know, realize, you know, where the water is around them, and it's all around them.
Right.
But if you can calculate that the dark matter that you're attached to right now, that is attached to the molecules in your body, the strings that make up the molecules in your body.
Okay.
They're like something like 100 trillionth of a millimeter from your body.
Wow.
You know how close that is?
Well, it's essentially me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you really,
I mean, I would need a pretty powerful microscope to see otherwise.
Well, you couldn't even see it with a microscope.
That's why, how I don't even, science fascinates me. I mean, I can understand gathering information big, you know, like through the outer universe, so to speak. But the quantum world always fascinates me how we diagnose this information.
Well, it's all theoretical. It's thought of in the minds of people. And that's an amazing thing because most of these things have been predicted to exist before they were discovered. So you think about that.
Predicted.
That people are able to mathematically predict the existence of much of the stuff we talked about, including black holes. They were mathematically predicted before they were discovered.
Wow.
That's why I tell my students, learn your math, kids. It's the key to the universe.
It is a universal language, isn't it?
Well, it's a universal language. It's the key to understanding the universe also.
Yeah. Well, is there a mathematics for time?
Well, there are equations that talk about time travel, yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
I mean, it's true because, you know, time is relative to the observer. I mean, if you're around the black hole, for example, you're orbiting around the black hole, let's say, but you don't go in, of course, because, you know, you wouldn't come back from our universe. If you're just going around the outside the event horizon of a black hole, and let's say you could instantly come back to Earth, and you thought that you were only around that black hole for a month, you'd come back to Earth and hundreds of thousands of years would have passed. But you're only a month older, and it was only a month to you.
Yes.
So this is more like time travel. And Einstein predicted this a long time ago, and now it's been theoretically proven. And how did they prove it? No, they did not go to a black hole. They figured that in the presence of gravitational fields, time is going to run at different rates.
Right.
So they took a radioactive clock, a cesium clock, which can measure time up to like to a billionth of a second. And they put one clock on Earth, and they took another clock in a high-altitude aircraft. They synchronized both clocks before they left. So one clock is on Earth in the Earth's gravitational field, and the other one is in high, you know, altitude, where the Earth's gravitational field is weaker.
Mm-hmm.
When they came back and compared the clocks, okay?
They were out of sync.
Like, yes, indicating that there were two different times, and they repeated the experiment a number of times and got the same results. So the clock on Earth actually went slower than the clock that was in high altitude.
Okay, now, because it's so funny, they've been showing a lot of this on TV, on the science channels lately, this whole idea of time. Now, the clock that you're speaking of, that's a clock where they actually can look at something happening like with an electron or something, or
no,
a photon,
no.
Or...
No, that's, you know, that's something totally different.
Oh, so that's not the type of clock
they... atomic clocks.
Atomic.
See, isotopes decay at a regular rate. So
okay.
There are particles leaving the nucleus of these isotopes, and they come out at a regular basis just like the ticking of a clock. You know, you listen
right.
to a clock and you hear it go click. Every click is a second.
Right.
So these atomic clocks are sending out particles, like a billion of them in a second.
Right.
So you can actually break down 1 second into like a billion parts.
Okay.
So, you know, so then... You know, you can actually measure small passages of time.
Okay.
So, you know,
that's the clocks. Right, but so my question would be, when it got, you know, closer to the gravitational or whatever the pull of the black hole is,
couldn't that be affecting cellular structure and how it exudes as particles, therefore changing the clock?
Well, I don't follow what you're talking about.
Well, meaning that time is different in these places in space because what happens to us scientifically is different what happens in these spaces.
Well, time is slowed down in gravitational fields.
Okay.
So if you're in that particular area of space where time is being slowed down, you're in that field. And also it's going to affect also your body. So your body is going to slow down also. But since your body, since the vibration of the strings in your body and the quantum signature of your body has changed, you're changed with it. So to you, time is going along in normally.
Even though it's actually changed.
Yeah, but outside of that field that you're in, time is moving at a different rate.
Okay, so stick with me here, and I get that you're the physicist here and I'm just a layperson. But this means that time is defined by how our beings or how certain things within, you said strings create certain things in, that turn into matter, right?
Right.
So is that theoretical or is that proven?
What?
That strings create. Yeah.
Well, everything's theoretical right now. We haven't even seen a string yet, but theoretically, mathematically, they should exist. And there's no reason to believe that they don't exist because,
Does it make sense?
Well, one of the things that they did, you see, in the vibration of certain strings and certain particles, there should be a particle produced that has a certain spin, a certain amount of energy.
Okay.
And that has been mathematically predicted, and it has been discovered. So it's a type of an electron.
Okay.
But anyway, the thing is that we're seeing particles being created now that could account and explain only be explained by string theory. So string theory was mathematically proven.
That's
just a unified theory. You see, Einstein for many years tried to tie in the entire universe together by a unifying theory, to tie all the forces of the universe together in one theory. He could never do it.
Okay.
And he came across something one time and dismissed it because it was so ridiculous that he figured it couldn't possibly exist. He called it his greatest blunder. But in fact, what Einstein was doing, he found the solution for tying the universe together, and it took 50 years after his death to finally realize that he was right, and he didn't even know he was right because he thought it was a ridiculous idea because it couldn't possibly be, but he discovered it first.
Right.
And it ended up our, let's say, forerunner of what today is string theory. String theory ties the entire universe together. It ties all of the forces of the universe together, and also it explains the weakness of gravity.
Yeah, which is really, that's another, because, I'm finding from my own spiritual experiences in life itself, things in life seem to be literally 180 degrees opposite of what I thought, just in my own experience, because for the science to prove that gravity is weak, that to me feels very, wow, that's nothing like I was taught. It appears, you drop something, it falls. Try doing the Stairmaster for 20 minutes. Clearly it feels like gravity is pulling us down, and yet there's so much obviously we don't know if we're now proving through science that gravity is weak.
Well, it is a weak force. When you consider the size of the Earth, it's not pulling you, it's not crushing you all the way down. And also, the fact is that if you have a compass, okay?
Right.
For example, the magnetic field of the Earth.
Okay.
The magnetic field of the Earth is attracted by a compass. That's also a very weak force. But, you can change it by, putting a magnet next to it. But
right.
The thing is that, if you look at our sun and the mass of our sun and the amount of gravity, that's being produced here that the sun is causing in space is that the pull on the Earth should be, you know, incredibly much, much greater, but it's not. But if you take into account all of these other dimensions that are in between, all the space that we can't see, that the gravity is filtering through, that...
that's,
you
why
know,
it's becoming...
You see, certain strings, okay? You see, they're closed strings. These closed strings cling on to the brains. Okay, imagine, not closed strings, open strings. These open strings cling on to the brain. Imagine that if you had a hook with a little hole in it so that you can clamp it down, it could hook onto a fabric,
okay,
like a shower curtain or something.
Okay.
Okay? Now, gravitons, which create gravity, are closed strings.
Okay.
They don't have any hooks in them, so they can't hook onto a brain. So they just roll across the brain and go from dimension to dimension to dimension throughout the universe. They're not restricted by any particular area of space. The whole universe is practically transparent to gravitons. They can actually probably travel from universe to universe.
Okay.
So you can imagine that. There are strings that are open and closed. The ones that are opened are hooked onto our universe and they're anchored there. While as the closed strings aren't anchored, they just roll across the brain, just like the water moving down the shower curtain or a pane of glass, and they're not hooked onto anything, so they travel through the universe.
Now,
this is why gravity can travel from point to point and be unrestricted practically by matter.
Okay, because this would kind of somewhat explain things of in the nature of like telepathy, things meaning our ability to move things without touching them. Would that be connected with this type of science?
Well, it may be. I mean, you know, it may be. I mean, you know, there's the physical universe is merely just a manifestation of the vibrations of these strings. And who knows, you know, the human body is part of that, but, you know, inside the human body is the spirit and the soul of an individual, a higher energy, so to speak, that's not connected to the physical universe. It's the only way it's connected to the physical universe is through the body,
right.
Almost like a driver driving in a car. I mean, you know, they're inside the car, but they're not the car. They're controlling the car. But they feel everything that the car goes over, a bump and whatever.
Right.
You know, they can control the car. But if you get the driver out of the car doesn't work. So, you know, whatever the soul is, the spirit is, it's coming from somewhere else, but it actually acts as the, you know, the body acts like the car on the road, and the spirit is the thing. But the point I'm trying to make is that outside the bounds of the physical universe is a universe of energy. And we're not talking about electromagnetic energy. We're talking about another form of energy in which perhaps the human spirit is part out of. So it can have a direct effect on matter. Yes, I mean, you know.
Right.
And the thing is, it's something like telepathy. I mean, radio waves travel at the speed of light. So if you're talking to somebody, let's say, on another part of the universe, if you're talking by radio, it could take thousands and thousands and sometimes millions and millions and billions of years for your signal to get there, depending how far away.
Right.
But perhaps telepathy communication can happen instantly, just like if the person's standing right next to you, because it goes beyond the realm of the physical universe where the entire multiverse is connected.
Right.
And I think this is an important fact that people should, you know, think about,
okay,
is because once you consider this, you know, you're taken out of your three-dimensional limited existence and expanding your mind to a much broader concept of what reality really is.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed, it's so funny because, you know, everything spiritual that I follow, it's called, you know, the goal is expanding consciousness, you know, recognizing ourselves as more than just our bodies, that, you know, that Because hasn't it been proven scientifically that, like, they take cells, and if they split them and they drive hundreds of miles, if they do something to a cell or part of the cell, they touch it simultaneously. It's not even a delay. It's actually exactly at the same time. The other part of the cell is affected by what we do to the other half?
I've heard something like that, but I'm not really, you know, I haven't really read the research that was done. I've heard something about that nature.
Okay, right.
You know, to the extent that it is, you know, I don't know, but...
Okay, I honor that. There's only so much, you know, a person can study in these kind of fields because
well,
it's so vast.
That's, you know, that's, talk about cell structure, that's more in biology, I don't know. It'll deal with that. Anyway.
Okay. Wait a minute. Phil, we have a caller with his hand up, so you're open to this, right?
With his hand up? What do you mean?
Meaning he wants to speak on the air.
Okay.
Okay. 908, you're on the air?
Hey, it's me.
Hey, you're on the air.
The cell experiment you're talking about is in the book called Biology of Belief.
Okay. Thank you.
So it says you got it right. That's roughly exactly what it says.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jay. Jay, say
all
hello
right.
to Phil. Do you want to add a comment anywhere else?
No. I just want to. You're right on. That's almost a verbatim depiction of what they talk about in the book. So.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
All right. I'll mute you out again.
That
is my friend Jay. He's He does engineer work, and he's very much works in the physics through metals and things of that nature in his engineering. So, okay, so let's go back to – well, and by the way, anybody is welcome to call in and ask Phil a question, a comment. The number to call in is 646-929-2084. You are listening to Another Reality Show. I'm here tonight with my wonderful friend and – incredible guest, Phil Imbrogno, with tremendous information about universes, dimensions. His latest book, Files from the Edge, can be located and purchased or pre-ordered purchased from Amazon.com. So let's go back to the idea that truly the paradigm of reality is shifting right now from us being, you know, I mean, because, God, there's still people on the planet that believe we're the only intelligence out there. I mean.
Yeah,
but,
well, I, you know, ants walking along through the, you know, doing their job believe that, you know, whatever they see in front of them is their universe. I mean,
you do push buttons. I love it, babe.
I mean,
I get it. Well, right. So you would have to say that even science supports right now that with all these, you know, universes and you know, so many potential stars that have the same, you know, environment, that there's clearly intelligence out there besides Earth.
You
right?
know what?
I mean,
if we're the only ones in this entire big universe just sitting here on planet Earth, I think that's a pretty sorry, you know, thing. I mean, you know,
it's almost
arrogant.
A
long time ago, a physics professor at MIT by the name of Phil Morrison, who I was in some of his classes. You know, he was really big back in the 50s and 60s about looking for extraterrestrial life.
Okay.
And, of course, back in the 50s and 60s, the mentality was different than it is today. People would talk about, would laugh and go, oh, yeah, you're going to go look for little green men, you know,
right.
stuff like that.
Right.
You know, and you have to remember, even in the 50s, the idea of going to the moon was laughed at.
Right, huh.
Okay. So, you know, one of them asked, you know, Dr. Morrison, news media, saying, what do you think the chances are of us finding aliens and little green men out there? And he said, well, he can't tell you what the chances are. He said, but he said, if we don't look, the chances are zero.
Right.
So the point is that people today, when they consider this, if they want to discover other realms other than their physical existence, they have to accept the idea that it's out there.
Right.
And by opening yourself up, you lead yourself to discover something. But if you close yourself off, the fact is that your chances of zero are expanding, of expanding outside of your reality are zero.
Right. And for you being a scientist, I so honor that you have that, you know, as a foundation to your investigations, because it seems on some level science is very close to certain sciences anyways. I mean, I don't get that physics or metaphysics are, but certain science seem like if you can't see it, touch it, feel it, taste it, or measure it, it doesn't exist. And
yeah, well, that's a mistake that's been made for centuries. You have to remember when in France, in the 1600s, when a farmer brought a rock into, you know, Paris, you know, at the university there, and said, they asked him, "Oh, it's a strange rock. Where did you get it?" He says, "It fell from the sky." They all laughed at him.
Okay. Well, what?
Because rocks can't possibly fall from the sky.
Oh, it was an asteroid of some kind?
No, it was
a
meteorite.
Or a meteorite, right.
Yeah.
So I see.
So sat in the University of Paris for another 150 years down in their thing until somebody, you know, when they accepted the idea of meteorites and they looked at it again and said,
I see.
It's a meteorite. But here's this poor guy, I mean, you know.
I had to bring it in.
Tell him, trying to tell people that it fell from the sky, and, you know, and he's laughed at and looked at like he's some type of nut. You compare that to what's happening today with what people are experiencing today with some incredible experiences, and they go and talk to certain people about it, and they're laughed at and say, "Well, that couldn't possibly exist because we know that doesn't, can't happen." Yeah, right. I'm like, come on, give me a break.
Yeah.
But,
well, anybody that thinks they know everything there is to know, you know, that isn't that the first pitfall of knowing the minute you think you know? I mean, because it seems the more I know, I don't know nothing. Man, everything that I thought I knew has been turned upside down just about.
Well, the more you know, the more you realize that you don't know.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, but the fact is that, you know, there's a lot of scientists, okay, who are secure in what they've learned.
Okay.
You see, and they spent all their life learning things certain ways. So when something radical comes along and it may be proven that everything that they learned is wrong and they're going to have to relearn something else, people are resistant to that. They're resistant to change because, you know, they don't want to think that, oh, gee, for the last 30 years I've been wrong.
Right.
But you have to remember something. Just because you're very well educated, just because you may have a genius IQ, that doesn't necessarily mean that you will not be dead wrong when you think about something that you think is the truth.
Right. Right. No. Well, I think science needs to. Well, and I hate you. We need, all of us need to get more exploration in. You know, meaning, in other words, stop looking at things because yesterday it was this way, making it must be this way today. I mean, that is where I think we fall into these boxes of, you know, it's almost like the universe will accommodate us in our limitation, but it will simultaneously, if we choose, accommodate us in our exploration and adventure and expansion of it. You know what I mean? It's like we just got to be open to not looking at things with the labels and the boxes, but more look at things like, instead of me telling life how it should look, let life show you what it is.
If you're ready to handle it.
Well, it is indeed. You have to be willing to embrace the unknown and or the unknowable. You know, even beyond the unknown, the unknowable, which is indeed, you know, that's one of my fears is, you know, I keep, you know, trugging along through my happy little expansion and expanding consciousness and doing all the work that I'm doing, and then I find myself going into an expanded space, and the first thing I start doing is labeling. The first thing I start doing is coming out of the present moment. I mean, there is a fearfulness in if it's as big as, you know, my imagination tells me it is, the feeling of being lost, it can quite easily come in, and that scares the bejesus out of me. You know, but on the same note, living a life of a flatlander scares me as well. I don't want to not experience the magic that is potentially available to all living beings right now. And, you know, and string theory, and when science supports it, it for me, it's like, okay, Goldie, let go of the mind that says it has to be like this. When science is starting to bring in more and more of, you know, string theory essentially says that in every single universe, every potential, like, you've gone left in a certain universe at the stop sign, you've gone right, you've gone straight, you know, a meteor dropped on you in another one, you know, it's like everything happened, now it just becomes the focus of what do you want to experience, because if it's all happening, you know, the options of what we can experience become greatly expanded. And, you know, I've experienced a pretty limited life in the sense of growing up, the whole fear thing. I want to experience now the magic, you know, all the things that, you know, they showed me as a kid, you know, the fairies and the angels and elves. Okay, well, where are those beings? Because I want to play with them.
Well, you know, you may not necessarily want to play with them. They may be, they may want to play with you.
Well, let's shift gears a little, because I love the science. I mean, you bring it, man. You just bring it. I do enjoy talking about that. But you also bring, you know, you bring the other dimensions in your experiences, and I mean, you have brought me to places where I've had these experiences, you know, because I understand that at this point we're going to kind of leave the science and more go to the idea that experiences have been showing up. It's almost like we're just acknowledging that they're showing up. You know, we can't even define per se. Oh, hello? Phil? Hello?
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 I'm back.
Okay.
Are you there?
Are you okay?
I got cut off for a while.
Yeah. Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm all right. Why?
I don't know, because whenever we start, when things start happening, I have to say, okay, is everything okay? That's so funny. That's 2 weeks in a row that something's happened on my phone. You know, let's just share. Okay, can we share a story from Files from the Edge?
Sure.
And then we can get into, you know, personal experiences. But and if you could just give a little background on whatever the situation was, that would be awesome.
Well, this took place in about 1970. And, it took place in Thailand.
Okay.
Okay. And I had heard stories, I was in the military then. I was doing some work, and that's another story, but long story. Anyway, I heard stories about, you know, something legends it's considered something like a boogeyman, you know, in Thailand.
Okay.
A creature.
Okay.
Okay. And I heard about I wanted to visit these ancient ruins. Okay. They were located up in a town called Pimai.
Okay.
And which is about, I think about 80 miles northeast of Bangkok.
Okay.
So here I am. I go up to there, and, you know, I'm by myself, and there's a little village out in front. And I start talking to the people. Of course, the Thai people are up in the northern part of the country are very friendly, you know, and they always have smiles on their faces. That's why Thailand is called the land of the smiling faces.
Oh, nice.
And the people are very friendly, you know, they invite me in, and the people invite me in their home. And there were like little huts rather than, you know, houses and stuff. There was no paved street. There was a dirt road.
Right.
You know, this was a villa, a little tiny little village. And you know, and I had some rice, and the amazing thing they had is that they didn't have anything else. You know, there were no restaurants or, you know, hamburger places.
Right.
You know, people would cook and grow their own food.
Right.
And but in this one particular little house, they had a refrigerator, and they were giving electricity by generators with gasoline.
Okay.
And there was a Coke machine.
Huh.
So I had a Coca-Cola, which was, you know, an amazing
thing. And it was
filled.
I mean, that's not, it's not just a machine. It had Coca-Cola.
Yeah, but it had, you know, it had Coca-Cola written on it in Thai.
Okay.
The Coke, you know, is all over the world.
Okay.
But the thing is that the fact is that the place was so primitive, but yet they had a freezer filled with Coca-Cola.
Okay.
You know, Coke is everywhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was talking, and some of the, you know, some of the elders and the shamans came in to me, and these people are Buddhists, by the way.
Okay.
And they said, and I was talking about the temples, and the temple ruins are like 1,600 years old.
Okay.
And they have incredible carvings on them and everything, and the vast. And they said, well, that there's a spirit that comes down from the hills, and he goes into the temple at night, and we give him food every night, and we leave flowers. And he takes them for his family. But if we don't do that, they're afraid that he's going to come into the village and, you know, go through the houses and take the food.
Right.
And they told me a story that 50 years before that time, which was about, you know, 1920 or something, this creature actually came into the village, ransacked it, you know, put, you know, two big containers of rice on one shoulder, and took two girls with them, two little girls who were 14 and 13 years old.
Wow.
And went back up in the hills with them. And I said, well, can you describe it? Well, they said, you know, they call him the wild man.
Okay.
And the fact is that this is like a Bigfoot-like creature. You know,
okay,
a Yeti,
that's what I was
sort
visualizing.
Of Bigfoot-like
okay.
creature. Standing up like a man with a lot of hair on its body, you know, and they consider it a spirit.
Okay.
So I said, wow, this is fascinating. They said, well, he comes down every night, I said, into the hills. And they said, yes, we have to bring food in there every night. And the actual ruins is about maybe about 3/4 mile from the village.
Okay.
Down a, you know, a dark path, a lonely path.
Okay.
And so I said to myself, you know, I'm just pretty young and everything. And, you know, I said, I got to see this. Because the fact is that back in the 60s, okay, I saw a movie on TV called Half Human that talked about the abominable snowman of the Himalayas, right?
Okay.
And about the creature, the Yeti and all. And at the end of the show, they talked about that this creature, this Yeti-like creature, is not only spotted in the Himalayas, but he's also spotted in different parts of the world, including Canada.
Okay.
And I felt kind of safe from where I was in my, you know, New York, you know, apartment with, you know, my mother and father and family, and I was only about 10 years old or something.
Right.
And it was 1961 or something. And but then I heard Canada, and I realized that we were in New York, and Canada was just up north. But, of course, they were talking about Canada in the northwest. Well,
okay.
Anyway, that movie actually made an impression on me most of my life, because I became fascinated with these creatures. So I started reading about them in the library and so on and so on. So when I was in Thailand, I heard about a similar creature. I just had to investigate.
Well, of course,
so
it's part of your journey. Yeah.
Yes, I went up to Pimai, you know, traveling through the country, you know, it was one of my more adventurous times. And and I come to the village, and once again, you know, the people greeted with me. They asked me, you know, if I was from India, because my skin was really dark.
Okay.
Because, you know, being an Italian and being out in the sun in Southeast Asia, my
wow.
skin gets really tan.
Okay.
So I said, no, I'm an American. And my Thai was about as good as their English.
English, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, Most of the exchange was done in the Thai language.
Okay.
Which I spoke, and I still speak quite well, but even I haven't used it in a long time. But I still say every once in a while I go to a Thai restaurant and order in Thai, and they get surprised.
Okay, indeed.
And they were really surprised one time when I went to a Thai restaurant in, like, Danbury, and I wanted to pay with baht, which is Thai money, which I still had with me at the time.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so I'm in the village, and they tell me about this wild man. And I said, This sounds like a Yeti to me. I said, I have got to see this. You mean it comes down every night? And they says, yes. So I wanted to walk down to the trail to the ruins before dark. And so I was down there taking pictures and, you know, of the ruins, and it's looking through the ruins. It's fantastic. And these ancient Buddhist, you know, ruins. Oh, fantastic. Anyway.
Are there glyphs and things like that? I mean.
What's that?
Glyphs or carvings or?
You know what, they're carvings in the rock. I mean, there's architecture and stuff.
Nice.
They're temples. They're old ancient temples.
Okay.
And it's one of the oldest temples in Southeast Asia.
Oh, wow.
It's in a town called Pimai. Anyway, the fact is that I'm there. I walk down there, and it's still light. I'm looking at the ruins. It's starting to get dark, okay?
Okay.
And I'm walking back through the main temple inside the stone thing and everything. And of course, nobody lives there now.
Okay.
It's ruins, you know, but it's still well preserved. And I'm saying to myself, gee, you know, what if I encounter this creature? How am I going to react?
Yeah.
You know, because I really believe that it was there. So I then hear something coming down from the hill, like something big, walking down through the brush in the jungle outside. After a minute, outside this area is like jungle.
Okay.
And I'm saying, what the heck is that? So I'm all alone, so I'm not going to hang around for this one. So I walk down the thing, and as I go down the main corridor inside the main part of the temple, and I come out the front entrance, and there are some, you know, people from the village, some Thai guys.
Okay.
And they had flowers and food, and they said, what are you doing in there to me? And I said, you know, I heard something coming down. They said, yes, that's him, that's the spirit. He said, it's a good thing that you didn't see him, because when you look directly into their eyes, you will die shortly after that. So that was part of the legend.
Okay.
If you look directly into their eyes, you will die. You will within a certain length of time after that.
Okay.
So they had flowers and they had a bunch of food. And I said, it's in there. It's coming down, the thing. And they were scared to go in, but one of the brave men went down in there and dropped off the food and ran back out.
Okay.
And I said to them, I want to go inside and see this thing. So I started walking, and they grabbed me, and they said, you know, they said to me, you kumbababo. It means you crazy.
That's how I'm feeling.
Said, you don't go in there when it's in there. And they said, if you go in there and you make it mad, it's going to take it out on the village and come down to the village and take our children away. And by the way, in that village, they still use that story about how the wild man came into the village and took these two girls away.
Right.
And they use it as a story, sort of like the boogeyman, that if the children aren't good, the parents say, well, the wild man, if you're not good, the wild man's going to come down and take you away, and you will never see your family again.
Ouch. Ouch. Okay.
So I don't want to upset anybody because it's dark, you know, and I'm going to have to stay in the village. And there was a family there that already offered to, you know, to give me a room to sleep in their, you know, their hut.
Okay.
So I didn't want to upset anybody because if I upset them, you know, the village elders would have said, get out of here.
Right.
And I would have to walk down the trail through the jungles all by myself at night.
Well, I mean, it's not the best thing to do. Yeah, you don't want to make your
dark roads, especially, you know, you don't know what's out there, especially.
It's Thailand, for God's sake.
Yeah, we're way up in the north country. Anyway, so I go into this house, okay, and the window's open, of course. You know, it's about 90 degrees at night.
Wait a minute,
and
a house or the temple?
Well, no, I'm outside the temple now.
Okay.
I go back to the village.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay, and I stay at this the house of these people.
Okay, okay.
These Thai people. As a matter of fact, you know, they were very nice and so on, and they gave me a little room, you know, which was their children's room, and the children slept with the parents at night, and they gave me that room. Now, that part of the hut, I mean, these aren't houses like we live in America back then.
Right.
These are like, you know, just like single-floor huts.
Like Gilligan's Island, right? I mean,
well, kind of like, but some of them, they're made of stone and stuff, okay?
Oh, okay.
But they have, you know, roofs that are a lot of straw on it and stuff like that. But the thing is that the windows are open, of course, and they have bamboo shades that can go up and down.
Okay.
And the room I was in, the window was facing towards the temple, which was about, I would say, about a half a mile from where I was staying.
Okay.
About 2 o'clock in the morning, I hear these sounds. Sounds like I've never heard before. Well, actually, I heard them over at Hawk Rock, but... anyway.
Oh, really?
And I'm saying, what the heck is that? It was coming, and it sounded like there were like 3 or 4 of them, like they were talking to each other and yelling. And I'm saying to myself, my gosh, you know, here I am in Thailand, and I was thinking about watching that movie, Half Human, back in the 60s when I was 10 years old, 61,
right.
And saying that, you know, about the Yeti. And here I am in a jungle village in Thailand, and there might be Yetis right down the road from me. My gosh, I'm saying, this is amazing. So the yelling and the yelping lasted till about 4 o'clock in the morning or something.
Did it sound
like
human or animal?
Well, it sounded animal, then it sounded, first it sounded like it was animal, then it sounded human, then it sounded animal again, like it was a combination of both.
Okay.
But they weren't growling and everything. They were kind of a yelps and woo. And I mean, kind of like, you know, almost like something that was changing back and forth between an animal and a human.
Shapeshift.
But it sounded like there were several of them.
Okay.
And the next day, you know, I woke up. I was pretty excited. And I had breakfast with them. And I met with the village elders and the shaman came over. And they said, and they had a Buddhist priest also who was there. And they were saying, yes, that's the wild man and his family. They came down and they eat in the temple the food we leave them. Okay, now the family of the wild man is evidently this creature took those 2 girls and took them for his mates or something. Because
like
now there's an entire family of them.
Like
and they're sort
breeding.
Of like, you know,
oh,
a cross
wow.
between humans and some. So I asked them if I could come back. I had to go back to my base. I was stationed I was living in a town called Korat in Thailand.
Okay.
And I was staying there, and that's where I was stationed. I had to go back. So I asked them that if I could come back with 2 of my friends.
Okay.
And they said sure, because you know they're all friendly and open and so on.
Right.
So I went back to the base. And you have to remember, and now this is during the Vietnam War, okay? And at that time, we were doing a lot of operations into Cambodia, and so I don't even want to talk about that. But anyway,
nope.
2 of friends, you remember, I was like a squad leader. I was a platoon leader. I was a unit leader.
Okay.
And I asked 2 of my friends, a fellow from Tennessee and another fellow who was from West Virginia. Both of these guys were crazy. Okay.
Crazier than
very
you?
Crazy.
Okay.
And I told them exactly where I was and what I experienced and what I heard. And they were like, you know, oh, come on, give me a break and so on. So I said, I want you 2 guys to come with me because I want to see this thing because I want to spend the night out in the temple and wait for this thing to come down and see it. And they were giving me all the things. I said, listen, if you come up with me, I'll make sure that you both get 3 days R&R, rest and relaxation, in Bangkok.
Yeah.
Okay,
because
I had the power to. I made you know the.
You could do that, right?
Yeah, and I said they said, of course, let's go. So, we had like a 3 days off. We had a weekend off and 3 days, and we went up to Phi Mai. We came in the village, and the villagers remembered me and they greeted me.
Okay.
Now you have to remember now we were carrying weapons.
Okay.
And I told the elders exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to go inside the temple, and we had 1 camera, we had 2 flashlights with extra batteries,
okay,
and that was it. remember, we were GIs.
You were kids,
you know?
Yeah.
Okay? So we're hanging around the village. We have dinner that night, and the elders said, no, they don't want us in the temple because they don't want to upset the wild man.
Okay,
because they're afraid that something's going to happen. And they see that, you know, we're carrying weapons on us. And we have, well, we have 45s. And they said 45 caliber Colts. It was the sidearm that was issued to military in that those days.
Okay.
They were afraid that we were going to, you know, they brought them on.
Kill their god.
They said, we can go into the temple and spend the night there if we leave our weapons behind. And my friend Charlie from West Virginia, you know, reluctantly, and this fellow by the name of Fussell from Tennessee, reluctantly turned over our weapons.
Because
they weren't going to let us in there.
Okay,
so we give them our weapons, and we make it down there before dark. And we're outside the main temple that faces the jungle. There's like a courtyard, like all stone, okay?
Okay.
Goes maybe about 20 feet, and then there's this jungle.
Okay.
So it's like a doorway that goes into the side of the main temple, and there's like a little courtyard that's maybe 20 feet by maybe 60 feet, and it's stone placed in the ground, and there's vegetation coming out, but it's, you know, it was a good place to put down, you know, the camp.
Okay.
So we're there, and it starts to get dark. Nothing's happening, okay? All of a sudden now, I'm seeing flashes of lightning in the distance. And I'm saying, oh, my gosh, you know, it's going to have a storm. And I start hearing thunder.
Right.
Now, at that time, it's about 2 o'clock in the morning now. And we hear this rustling coming down the hill, like something big is moving towards the jungle, towards us. More than one thing. Now, all of a sudden now, the storm approaches and it's pouring rain. We take up our sleeping bags and we go inside the temple entrance. Okay? And we're at the doorway because it's all open. You know, it's stone. It's all open.
Right.
And we're looking out into the thing, into the patio in the jungle. And Fussell, who's a, you know, crazy guy, he actually says, I'm going to go out there and see what's going on. Now, something happened there is that our flashlights started to die.
Yeah,
now, these were the days before alkaline batteries, remember?
Right.
They just had the 9 Lives ever-ready carbon batteries.
Okay.
So we just put fresh batteries in, and they started to die also. Like something was draining the energy from them.
Exactly.
Which now, today, we know happens in paranormal locations. Things like batteries die very quickly. And we've seen that in the chamber areas.
Exactly.
Now, Fussell goes out. I'm kind of shining the light to find out what's going on here. The batteries are getting very weak, but we still had a light. And Fussell goes out to the front of the jungle area, and out of the bush, this enormous figure jumps out. Now, it's dark. It's all silhouetted, but its eyes are glowing like yellow.
Mm.
Now, he's standing maybe about 10 feet in front of it, and he's like yelling, what are you? You know, but it jumped out, and then it saw our lights, and it acted like it was on a trampoline. It just jumped back into the bush, but it didn't make a crash when it went in.
Right.
But we got a pretty good view of it, and it was this sort of like hairy and so on, but it was pretty dark. So I call Fussell back, and he won't come back. And he starts going up and down, imitating like an orangutan, going, distracted. I go, what are you trying to do? He's saying, I'm trying to get it to come back out again.
He wasn't frightened by this?
No, but get this.
Okay.
In the jungle, we're shining the light right into the jungle, and he's going like this, imitating orangutan.
Right.
Scratching himself and going, yelling and screaming like he's an ape.
Okay.
As we shine the lights into the jungle area, there are 3 sets of eyes.
Oh,
reflecting off the lights. And they look like they're looking at him, laughing almost, you know? I think he was entertaining them. Then Charlie was freaking out. He was saying to me, my gosh, he went over to where Fussell was, and he's looking into these eyes, and Fussell's looking into these eyes. I didn't see him that well because I was trying to get the light to work and trying to get Fussell to come in, and at the same time, the rain is coming down so hard,
that's right.
You can barely even see him. We're soaking wet. So what happens is that Charlie starts freaking out that these things are going to get us and so on. So he picks up this big stone, and he throws it into the jungle.
Oh, so let's antagonize them.
There's a thump, like it hits something, solid and dull.
Okay.
Then all of a sudden, the eyes just vanish. The eyes just vanish.
Wow.
And that's it. We don't hear anything or see anything for the entire night.
Now, wait, question. Was there food and flowers left this evening as well?
Yeah, they were inside the temple. I think those creatures were kind of angry that they didn't get to get it because we were there.
Night.
They weren't going to cross our path.
Okay.
But I think the leader or the big one started to come in and was trying to communicate with Fussell, who was sitting there acting like a gorilla.
Okay.
He must have said, who the hell are these crazy people? Anyway, so dawn comes along, and we go out to the jungle to look for footsteps or something or broken something. There's nothing. No evidence at all. But it was raining, so I don't think we'd find anything anyway.
Right.
But there were no broken bushes or anything. So we went back to the village, you know, because we had to go back. And these two guys, they wanted to take the guns and go back there tonight and shoot the thing and bring it back. And of course, you know, the village elders are saying, no way, no way, no way, so and so. It was
right. A
big argument, a big fight. And one of the shamans, one of the magicians or shamans of magic, knew all about the thing. He said, you went up and looked into the eyes. He said,
That
was bad. You are going to die. And they laughed, of course. But we left. Because we had to go back because, you know, the Vietnam War was calling. Do you know that Charlie and Fussell were killed within a few weeks after that incident in combat? But the thing is, of course, nothing happened to me. I didn't really look into the eyes. I didn't really stare into the eyes. Just I was busy
trying
to get
the
flashlight to work
right.
So I could see what the heck was going on. So everything happened so fast. And plus
mm-hmm.
the rain. But they went up and they looked and stared into the eyes, and they told me how the eyes made them feel cold. And they were both dead within 3 weeks.
Wow.
And the shaman told them, you should have never looked into the eyes.
Yeah.
Anyway, after that, I went down to, I got intrigued by this. I didn't go back up because we weren't invited back. And because they were afraid because we were going to come back and shoot the thing.
Right.
So, and of course, you know, they thought it was a spirit. So I went
Well, what makes
to the
you
university.
Think it's not?
Well, you know, at the time I thought it was a Bigfoot.
Okay.
It could have been. I don't know. It could have come from another dimension.
Okay.
But the thing is that I went down to the University of Bangkok one of my next, you know, times off, and I went and saw a professor in anthropology down there. And I explained to him what happened up at Pimai, and I described it, and he was, like, intrigued. And he said, maybe you saw an orangutan. And I said, but there are no orangutans in Thailand. They're only in Borneo, and they're very rare. He said, yeah, but at one time there were orangutans in Thailand, but they became extinct. And the orangutan is a direct cousin of this gigantopus, which was like a giant ape.
Okay.
Which was like 10 feet tall. And this figure we saw was about 8 or 9 feet tall.
Okay.
And I explained to him, he really didn't believe. He said, well, maybe it's possible, he said, that there could be families of orangutans left in the Thai jungles, just nobody would find them because some of it's pretty desolate. And maybe they're not all extinct, and maybe you guys, because of the rain and the lightning and because it was dark and you heard about the legends, you misinterpreted what you saw. I said, no, Fossil was 6'4". I said, and this creature was standing close to him, and he looked like a little boy next to him.
Right.
I said, and it stood up straight. I saw the shadow of it, and Fossil said he got a good look at it, and it had red hair. So this professor at Bangkok University really didn't, he was kind of like, well, maybe you saw this and the lightning and the rain, you misinterpreted it and so on and so on. Really didn't believe, you know, the
clearly,
fact.
Clearly, clearly. Right, right. He
so,
was justifying it.
The thing is that, you know, I never went back up there.
Hmm.
But, you know, and I kind of like wrote the story down of that encounter. Also, years later, okay, the ruins became, about 10 years later, the ruins at Phi Mai became a national park. The Thai government acknowledged it as, you know, one of these, you know, sites, you know.
Right, right.
Historical
site
for the country.
Right.
So they put a lot of money into it, and they stopped the ruins from decaying. The village, that the little tiny village,
right,
ended up into a big village. Then it ended up into a big town. And now today, you know, I was kind of looking at it online.
Yeah.
It's a little city now there. It even has a McDonald's.
Well, so you're saying that abundance came to this city, right? That's a good thing, though, right?
Yes, but, you know, a lot of visitors now, Americans, Europeans, you know, Buddhists from all around the world, they
right.
go and visit the ruins, so they made it a national park now. They even got, you know, souvenirs there and everything.
Right.
But the thing is that when I was there in 1970, and the wild man was there, the wild man is no longer spotted. It seems that as the place got more populated and more people were coming to the ruins, this wild man, whatever it was, a Bigfoot, a Yeti or whatever,
stopped.
It never came back to the temple. And all the people have there, the very older people who were young when I saw them, who are now like grandfathers,
right?
All they have is the legends of the creature there. But today, I mean, I was shocked to see the size of that little tiny village, and there was even a McDonald's there.
Okay.
Unbelievable. But
yeah,
the wild man, he probably left. Who knows? Maybe he went back to his dimension with his family or something.
Well, I'm surprised that it, you know, there wasn't, like there are legends that are told where people try to build at these places, and what happens is it actually, the business deals fall through. You know, in other words, if the spirit didn't want it, I believe the spirit could have easily made things not work.
Well, maybe not. Maybe, you know, human nature and human stuff drove it out, that it didn't want to deal with it. And plus, if it was sort of like a throwover from the Ice Age or something, or something
then
that
it would
was
just thought
to be extinct, and there were too many people around, and it could have taken off into the further hills and
deeper in the jungle. Yeah, exactly.
Further back, you know, who knows what the true answer is. But the fact is that whatever that creature was, I would call it, you know, a Yeti or a Bigfoot. But it, according to, you know, my friend who got really close to it before he died, he said it had red hair, but it had a face that looked like a man. And he got a pretty good look at it because he was only like about 10 feet away from it.
Well, red would be kind of the orangutan. I mean,
that's right. That's why this professor at Bangkok University thought maybe we saw an orangutan, but orangutans were extinct in Thailand. But he says, you know, who knows, maybe a family of orangutans. But orangutans aren't, you know, 9 feet tall.
Agreed.
And
great.
Orangutans do not stand straight up.
Right.
Okay? And they can't jump back into the woods like they were from a trampoline. And I saw that, and it was a dark image to me. But, you know, as soon as I got the light really going, working with, like, the batteries and shaking them up a little bit, and I shined the light, this thing didn't like the light. Its eyes glowed yellow. And when the light hit it, and it just jumped back into the jungle as if it just sprang off a trampoline.
Yeah.
But when it went into the jungle, it didn't make any noise. like a crashing down in the trees or something.
Right, right.
And then these three sets of eyes appear that are all yellow, and they're watching my friend imitate a gorilla to try to get them out again. He figured if he acted like an ape or something, they would come out, and he could see them again, and we could see them.
Now, who had the camera?
The thing is, we had a camera there.
Yeah.
And we were trying to take pictures. The batteries in the camera died, and the flash didn't work.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you know, it's almost as if, you know, something didn't want us to take the picture. But we had just put the fresh batteries in the camera. These are the old days with the old flashes, you know,
right,
where,
right.
You know, where you had to change the bulb.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
You know, so we're talking about, you know,
a few years ago.
39 years ago, almost 40 years ago. Going on.
Wow, wow, wow. So, and you're online, and well, I guess, and there's nothing happening at that village. Wow. Well, you know, it's so interesting because there was war going on at that time, too. Maybe the war was pushing it to the edge.
Well, there was no war in Thailand, although there were, you know, guerrilla fights, and there were some Thai communists, and there was some activity in certain parts of Thailand along the Cambodian border. But for the most part, Thailand was it was pretty isolated from the Vietnam and Southeast Asian War.
Okay.
So,
so
you
that,
know,
that wouldn't be a factor then.
Yeah,
right.
There wasn't, you know, the war wasn't really affected there. You know, Thailand was an American ally, so there were a lot of American military bases in Thailand. And I spent some time in Thailand because of my time over there. But, you know, the fact is that, you know, the amazing thing is this. I mean, you know, I was watching this movie called Half Human about the Yeti. Who knew that someday that I would be almost be confronting by something like a creature like this? And it just amazes me today that that I was able to, you know, fulfill that. You know, I was in that
Indeed.
Situation. The odds are, you know, really against that happening to me. But, you know, I still think about that. But this is like one of the stories files from the edge.
Okay, so this isn't like from, because I thought the tapes you had in that closet were a woman or something, or some sort of documenting of, I don't know if it was the guy who had given you those pictures, you know, that you had showed us with the language on it, and I thought I had the feeling it was a woman channeling or something, or.
Well, there I have a lot of tapes with women channeling.
In that closet, but that's what I thought the book was on. Is what I'm saying.
Well, no, you know, the book is on various things of paranormal investigations.
Personally,
I mean, you know,
okay.
The book that's coming out in December of 2010 called Contact from Beyond the Stars actually deals with a lot of the things that you're talking about, which is, you know, my continuing investigation into people who are channeling and people who claim contact with not only aliens, but angels and other entities also.
Right, right.
And, you know, but Files from the Edge is coming out in April, but Interdimensional Universe is out there too, but that's more like a UFO book that ties in the idea of parallel universes and so on. But in Files from the Edge, I also start out with the concept of different realities and parallel universes because, you see, it's an important part of this whole paranormal thing. And not only are some of my experiences, my adventures in Files from the Edge, but most of it's composed of cases that I've investigated in the United States and also, you know, in different parts of the world. So it's sort of like something I've just been sitting on for years, and because Interdimensional Universe was somewhat of a success, when I pitched the idea of Files from the Edge to the publisher, you know, they jumped on it immediately, and they wanted me to do the manuscript. They even pushed me to get it done a lot quicker than I wanted to because they wanted to get it out there because they realized a lot of these cases were going to be of great interest to people who are exploring this sort of thing. Because how many people, you know, are going to go to Nepal or Thailand to track down, you know, paranormal things?
Right.
I mean, you can read about it.
Right.
and, you know, and read about other people's experiences. Like for example, in Nepal was also like a Yeti experience, but I didn't see anything. But I was talking to people who had experiences in the Himalaya Mountains, seeing these creatures for years. So, you know, the fact is that they consider them spirits also. And like the people in Thailand, they say that if you meet one face-to-face and look in its eyes, you will die within a short period of time.
I wonder whether that was just a coincidence,
but, you know, those two buddies of mine, my two friends,
yeah,
who were in my unit, I mean, you know, they both died at the same time within a short period of time after having that encounter at the temple.
They literally died at the same time?
They died at the same time.
Wow, see, now that's also...
Well, just about the same time, within a couple-day time period.
Okay, well, I mean, because that just supports... Because, you know, there are legends and myths and curses. You know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, everything, you know, it's not what's possible, what's not possible. It's all possible, you know, whatever people are experiencing, whether it be from ley lines or chambers or, you know, these other places around the globe that clearly have, you know, energetics going on that, you know, because, I mean, one of the questions that's coming through my mind, how were you connected with the shamans from this village? I mean, just from an early on age, you know, you were able to connect with them?
No, I mean, you know, I just went up there and talked to them. That's all, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm finding that to be, you know, clearly part of your journey. Because, I mean, I guess you're in Thailand, I get that. But, because, I mean, meeting shamans along the journey is almost just as important as meeting the Yeti, you know, to help you understand the whole experience.
Well, most of these villages, they have, you know, a priest nearby, Buddhist priest, and a shaman, because they're still connected to the, you know, the old nature ways.
Right.
You know, and...
Right, that's true, okay.
You know, but you see, the fact is that, you know, despite this, you know, if you go back to that village today, it's not a little village anymore. You know, it's a small...
It's industrialized.
...town, you know?
Right.
And they got... The roads are paved... There's, you know, cars there now, you know, they got a sort of like an admissions thing into the temple and they got a gate around it and they got guards and, you know, it's almost like a public attraction. They even got a hotel in the area. I mean, you know, it's nothing in comparison to what it was, but I'm saying that the people who lived there at one time had a close-knit little society.
Right.
And they were held together by these legends and the shaman. But I bet if you go there now, you know, most of them, you know, a lot of the older ones are gone, and the younger ones don't remember the legend, and the town is not as friendly as probably as it used to be.
Wow.
And you know, the fact is that what I'm saying is that sometimes these legends and these stories and these old beliefs keep a people together and keep them together in a way that, you know, doesn't corrupt them. And then when you bring in, you know, get rid of the legends and the mythology and the stories, they don't have that anymore, and the people just fall apart. And now, I mean, I bet you some of them, you know, some of the little babies that I saw, they are probably, you know, managers in the McDonald's that opened up there.
Yeah.
I would have never, when I was up there going through this village, walking down the dirt road to this village, seeing these huts and stuff, never think that someday there would be paved roads there with hotels and a McDonald's and another restaurant and, you know, buildings now.
Well, you know, the interesting thing as you speak about this is, you know, I'm not quite sure to consider that, you know, a blessing for that village or in actuality... You know, that they really are now at a loss because they've been industrialized.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the whole thing. You know, I haven't been back there since that time, and I'm sure the people aren't the same that live there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure if you go in, nobody's going to invite you into their home and, you know, and offer you food and a place to stay for free.
Right. Yeah.
And of course, the idea of the wild man, the, you know, the spirit of the temple, is just a story now.
Well, do you think it still is a story? Do you think that the myth continues? It's just that there's nobody going up to the temple to put food down and flowers and.
No, nobody does that anymore because, you know, there's guards there now. It's like a national park.
Right, so they commercialized everything. And why would the Yeti or whatever it was come if there's nothing? Well, first of all, it's populated. And second of all, they're not leaving the things anymore.
Yeah, and even if it lived close by, it probably took off because it didn't want to deal with people.
Right.
And,
right.
So, you know, this is what we see in a lot of these places that were once small villages that had all of these stories and myths and everything. And I think the people lose something from that, you know. Because
lose something from?
You know, they lose it. What they do is they lose a lot of their heritage.
Right.
And, you see, you had to be there when you walked through the 1970, when you walked through this village and see how simple it was.
Yeah.
How friendly the people were, how they were all happy. And I'm sure it's a different story when you go there now.
Yeah.
And the temple itself, the ruins, are, you know, it's national park. I mean, the Thai government has preserved it, but still, you know, with that, which is good, but also it brought in a lot of other negative aspects to the village to affect their culture. I'm sure the people living there aren't as happy as they were before.
No, the only thing I've come close to noticing that with is I used to go to Sedona, Arizona a lot. It was like my little Mecca. And I took a few years off in like 5 years and went back. And I swear, in 5 years, the commercialism, I mean, it was definitely, it had a commercialism to it, but it was all very kind of like mom and pop kind of commercial, meaning people, it was a very unique to Sedona. And the last time I went there, there was literally KFC, Pizza Hut, there was a Walmart, and it was like, wow, I don't know, it really seemed to, it's like there is an authenticity that is diminished through capitalism, industrialism.
There's a lot of people going out to Sedona to experience things, and a lot of people are trying to cash in on it, too.
Literally.
Maybe I expected somebody to go back to the village now up there and you know, see a gift shop with little replicas of the wild man from the temple.
Right.
I mean, you know.
Right.
I mean, or posters or something, or the legends of the book, but
yeah.
I don't know. You know, it's something that's gone. It's in the past, and you know, it's changed, and many places are like that today.
Yeah, well, I mean, I get change is. I just often believe that sometimes what we think is progression, you know, it's like. There's a lot of work being done around, you know, like the Mayans and stuff with the whole 2012 and everything. And, you know, we look back on these cultures like the Mayan and, you know, the Aztecs and the Anasazi. And, you know, it's like it seems like we don't see a technology around them. So we assume that they were prehistoric and behind us. And yet my sense of everything is that they had an inner technology in them. That they didn't need, you know, like they were tracking the stars and they were doing it without telescopes and things, you know, and without Hubble spacecrafts, you know. And somehow they seemed to know things, kind of like what you were saying earlier, that science was being predicted before it came, you know, that it doesn't just have to be something physical in order for it to be authentic. You know, it's like there's a magical aspect to this that technology seems to just squash out. And I think it's a shame when we lose that.
That's true. But, you know, what happens with technology is that humans become more dependent upon the technology and they separate themselves from their natural instincts and their true connection to the universe.
And that is a weakness, not a strength.
Well, it is a weakness. But you see, the technology gives us a strength, but it also weakens us inside. It also weakens who we are as a person, and it takes away a lot of our individuality.
Exactly. It starts programming. We start becoming robotic.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is that people become dependent upon this technology. For example, you know, 30 years ago, cell phones. There were no cell phones.
Right.
People got along without them. They didn't care about them. Now, everybody has, just about everybody has a cell phone, and, you know, and people say, I can't live without my cell phone.
Yes, you can.
It's become part of it. And, you know, and you know, so you have things like the Internet.
Indeed.
I mean, you know, in 1980, 1970, there was no such thing as the Internet, really. The military had the Internet. The government had an Internet.
Well, and these are rooms and rooms and rooms of computers.
Yeah, and now people need the Internet. You know, they want the Internet. They can't live without it. And we become dependent upon the technology. And the fact is that we take a loss when we do this, because since we have a technological device that is making this connection with, you know, the world we have around us, we lose it within ourselves.
I agree. GPSs are next.
Well, everybody's getting GPS. I mean, I have to admit, I have a cell phone, but I say as soon as I retire, that cell phone is going in the garbage.
Really?
Because I don't even like to talk on the phone.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, why would I want a cell phone around me, except, you know, if I'm in a flat tire or something.
Well, that's exactly right. If you travel, it's a wonderful thing, but, you know, clearly,
sure.
I mean, people are in grocery stores, restaurants. I mean,
oh,
it's amazing.
People are obsessed with their phones. They're constantly looking at them, seeing what messages and texting back and forth.
That is so funny. I saw a cop today who was on, you know, traffic duty.
Yeah.
Texting. I was cracking up going, you are texting and you're supposed to be guiding traffic.
Well, I'm telling you, you know, people get obsessed with their phone and, you know, and they lose something in that. You see, they spend a lot of time with this technology and they lose time within themselves to find their inner self. They're always like projecting themselves outward through technology.
Yes.
And they're losing the projection inward to finding out who they really are and what's really inside them and their true connection to the universe, rather than using a technological device to substitute a connection.
Absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly. All right, well, we have about 15 more minutes. I don't know where to go. Should we go to interdimensional universe or shamanism? I don't know where to go with you.
I can go anywhere.
Well, let's go to the chambers a little. Now, the Hudson Valley is, you know, I mean, literally, okay, what is the radius approximately of the Hudson Valley?
The radius?
Or meaning, how many miles is this
space?
Well,
I don't know. It goes all the way down from, you know, like New York City all the way up to, I think, you know, Kingston and even up to Albany, I think.
Okay, so it's a good 50 miles square miles?
Well, it's more than 50 square miles. If you're talking about a radius, maybe it's about 50 mile radius.
Oh, okay. So and in this space, I mean, there's chambers, there's UFO activities, there's ley lines. There are ley lines, because you were saying that the chambers were built on ley lines, correct?
Well, they're built on magnetic lines of force, I guess, if you want to call them ley lines.
Is there a difference between that?
I think there are, because when people talk about ley lines, I assume they're talking about the magnetic lines of force that are coming from the Earth.
That is what I'm talking about.
But the fact is that some people claim that these ley lines, you know, aren't magnetic, so I would assume that they're magnetic lines of force.
Because that's what the birds...
The chambers
and...
are built on, the magnetic lines of force, you know.
Okay.
You can call them ley lines or whatever, you know.
Okay, yes, maybe I'm... it is similar to things like the Stonehenge and how they're lined up, and Egypt and how those are lined. Meaning the stars and the Earth and these chambers have a connection. in where they're, how they're...
Well, they do in their alignments, yeah. I mean, you know, somebody built them with the celestial sphere in mind, I mean, because of the way they're facing, and some of them line up with the sun at certain times of the year, and some of them, you know, line up with certain stars and certain directions in the sky. So obviously somebody had a thought about a connection with the sky and the universe when they built these stone structures in New York, you know, which are a mystery. I mean, they're lost in time. You know, I'm beginning to believe that they are, you know, they go back a considerably long time, you know, more than a couple thousand years ago. I think they may even, they may even go back like 10,000 years. I mean,
nice.
You know,
yeah.
Not
yeah.
all of them, but I think some of them do. I think, you know, a very ancient people built them that had a technology that, you know, that we don't have today. And it was not an instrument technology. They utilized the natural forces of nature to cut and move those stones.
Well, exactly, which is, isn't that the same principle for the Mayan pyramids as well as the Egyptians?
Well, that's what people think. I mean, you know, the pyramids of Egypt, I mean, you know, it would take thousands of people working, you know, a long time to move those stones. And
perfectly, though, and set them perfectly.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, there was a much different technique used than what we think. And, you know, somebody had it. They're probably a lot older than we think they are, too.
Right. Yeah, I think
just like Stonehenge and
Newgrange,
right. You know, and all of these structures around the world, which are pretty old. I mean, and they're finding out every time, like the Sphinx, it's older and older and older and older.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, and the thing is that what cracks me up is that a lot of these people who study, these archaeologists and stuff, they come up with this idea that they've read about in their textbooks, that they've learned from their professors, and they hang on to these old ideas, and they don't look for new ideas or new evidence, and they try to stay locked into these concepts, and after a while they realize that they may be wrong.
Right. Well, I guess, you know, it's always funny. It's like, evolution will shift consciousness even if we don't choose it. It almost feels like there's something within us, that even if we have certain beliefs, whether we're scientists or teachers or whatever, it just seems that there's something happening within us that if it's not a truth, the truth is becoming unveiled one way or another, whether it's, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls becoming, you know, all of a sudden being found, or people doing work from expanded levels of consciousness. You know, I mean, I work with a teacher that works with oracles that don't work in this dimension, but they're bringing back information that affects this dimension. So it just seems like when there's a moment and a frequency and a space that's right for certain truths to be coming out, whether it's Atlantis sinking or the Egyptians, is going to come out. You know, we can't stop the natural progression of evolution. It's happening.
There's more information coming out about a great many things. In the 50s and 60s, you would have never heard about this stuff.
Exactly.
And, for example, I was looking at the History Channel the other day. They were talking about they found the Gospel of Judas.
Okay.
And our concept of Judas and who he was is completely wrong. The church just made him into a villain.
Oh, Judas is the one that supposedly betrayed Jesus,
yeah.
Correct? Okay.
Yeah, but they found the gospel, something that Judas wrote. And his view of everything was completely different as to what, you know, the Catholic Church says Judas did. And
stunner.
and I mean, you know, and you know, he has a completely different view of, you know, what happened at that time, you know, which, of course, it wasn't rewritten by the Catholic Church. I mean,
right.
You know,
right.
So they're finding out Judas now was not this big traitor and this big villain that, you know, he had it planned with Jesus to turn him in because Jesus wanted to be crucified.
Really? That's what the book says, that he wanted
to fulfill the prophecy, yeah. He arranged for Jesus. They talked about, you know, Judas arranging for him to be arrested, and Judas was actually like his best friend.
Yeah.
I mean,
wow.
You know, and it had to be arranged that way because Jesus did everything right. He wanted to follow the prophecy that before of Daniel and Isaiah of the Messiah, what would happen to the Messiah, and Jesus arranged for a lot of this stuff to happen to fulfill the prophecy.
Yeah, well, you know, I am a firm believer that, like, prophecy makes sense to me because it almost seems like there are certain things, like I said, that kind of are in, and, you know, this could even take us back to the string theory, they're already in a progression that like, things will happen that are going to shift our consciousness, you know, even if the powers that be don't want this shift in consciousness to come about. You know, like, when it's time, it's going to be because, like, I keep going back to, you know, the government going, you know, UFOs do not exist. And it's like, you know, the minute we started inventing camcorders, it was going to be a matter of, you know, time before people were personally going to videotape experiences going on in the, you know, in the night sky and in the day sky. So, you know, and again, I guess, see, this is where I'm a little contradicting. It's like, oh, well, there's technology showing us certain things. But I think technology is a beautiful thing when it works with consciousness. And soul and things of that nature. And when we take technology and use it, you know, just for, like, weapons and things of that nature, that we lose the essence of what technology really could do, which is, you know, we can use it for medical reasons or we can use it to blow up, you know, small villages.
Well, that's, you know, human nature, what can I tell you?
Well, but that's why I think, I agree that it's human nature, but I also believe that there's an underlying consciousness that is what we believe is, you know, what has always been. When it's time for that to shift, which I believe we're in right now, what has always been will evolve. It will, whether, you know, we believe it or not. It'll happen underneath it because there are just so many things showing up right now. Like, these kids are just amazing. I don't know if you have it in your school, but I mean, I read stories and I listen to interviews, and just in my own nannying experiences, you know, I was with a 2-year-old the other day having lunch, and a couple walked into the Burger King that me and the little girl were sitting in, and she looked at me and she goes, "That's a bad man." And I said, "How do you know that?" And she goes, "He told me." And I go, a bad man? I go, is he a, you know, bad man? Like, he in his body, you know, is he going to go, or he's going to go to a bad place? And I went, is he going to die, or is he going to go to, like, a bad building? And she goes, he's going to go to a bad building. I mean, it was like, how does she know that? I mean, they were literally 25 feet across, and she's 2 years old. It's not like she's been programmed yet for a prejudice. You know, it's like, I look and I go, what would prompt her to say that? Other than, my personal belief is there's a, you know, telekinesis or telepathic, you know, soul language that before they're told it's not, that's what they live on. You know, that's what she's expressing. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, well,
you know, things you can't explain, so
you know,
to speak.
A lot of the kids today, their consciousness is different than.
Yeah. Yeah. So we are up at the top of the second hour, and we got a couple of minutes. I want to plug the book again, Files from the Edge. That's Phil's latest book. It can be pre-ordered on Amazon.com.
Yeah.
And what I'm actually going to do is I'm going to see if I can get that book on the episode page, so because they have direct links to Amazon. So if you check back, on the episode page, I will have that up, our little friend that we can hear. And Interdimensional Universe, that's out there now.
Yeah.
It's a great book.
And if you call 1-800-THE-MOON, they have it on sale at the publisher. You can get a better price than Amazon.
Oh, thank you for that. 1-800-THE-MOON for Interdimensional Universe by Phil Imbrogno. Phil, thank you so much. I know you had a long day.
Yep. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. I got to be up again. And
teach those wonderful new expanded conscious beings.
Oh, yeah.
Called fifth graders, sixth graders, and eighth graders. So are you doing any talks or anything that you're plugging? Anything coming up for you?
No, I'm just now talking about doing something for the Discovery Channel, but that's about it.
Okay. Well, I will definitely, keep the listeners informed.
It's going to be on the Stone Chambers, by the way.
Oh, outstanding. And actually, Christmas Eve, December 24th, Phil will be returning with our mutual dear friend, Rosemarie Guiley. And we're going to just have a show about interdimensional stuff.
The djinn.
We will talk about the book that they're creating and, wonderful goblins and ghouls and Santa Claus and elves. Because I got to get my 2 cents in. So thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Next week is the goddess Sophia. We'll be back on for a third Thursday. And I hope everybody has a fabulous week. Thanks for joining me. Take care, everybody.
Adios.
Bye, Phil.